This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 14, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The final presidential debate happened in Arizona last night. Kerry accused Bush of ignoring African-American issues. We look at Kerry's record. New statistics say whistleblower complaints of abuse in government are going largely uninvestigated. And in our continuing election countdown coverage, today we look at the disenfranchisement of ex-felons across the country. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Financial strategists around the world are concerned that today's economic news may indicate a much weaker U.S. economy than previously thought. The U.S. trade deficit is at its second highest in history, mostly due to the purchase of foreign oil at ever-rising prices. Combined with non-oil imports, the trade deficit is even larger than predicted by U.S. Commerce Department officials. Last year's trade deficit is the highest in history to date. Bush administration officials say the deficit shows a stronger U.S. economy because it means that people are buying more. Also, the Department of Labor statistics released first-time unemployment claims higher than those forecasted. 352,000 people filed for the benefits last week. As international oil prices continue to soar, Shell Petroleum has cut down oil export from Nigeria following a fire on one of its main pipelines. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos.
This is the second time Shell Petroleum is cutting oil production in Nigeria in the last 2 weeks. Late last month, the company had to pull out some of its workers from some oil locations following fighting between Nigerian troops and an armed group that wants autonomy for the Niger Delta region. Crisis in the Niger Delta and an ongoing general strike in Nigeria have helped push up international oil prices. The country's two main oil workers' union say they will join the general strike, which will now most likely be extended past tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Today, General Motors spokespersons announced plans to cut 12,000 jobs at its car plants across Europe. Most of those plants will be in Germany. From Bonn, Guy Deegan reports.
Under General Motors' job cut plan, its German subsidiary, Opel, will be the hardest hit. German trade union officials say GM plans to cut 8,000 jobs from its Opel factories in Bochum and Rosersheim. General Motors' European operation has not made a profit in 4 years, and the company says the job cuts are part of a $600 million plan to slash production costs. Plant closures in Germany have not been ruled out. Opel's workers' representative, Klaus Franz, says his members will not let any German plants close without a fight, and a Europe-wide day of action is planned for next week to give a clear signal that workers are prepared for confrontation. Meanwhile, right-wing opposition parties, buoyed by recent state election successes, were quick to blame the Social Democrat Green Coalition government's economic policy for the job crisis facing Germany's car industry. In Bonn, Germany, this is Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
Six U.S. soldiers have been found guilty this week of abusing ethnic Albanian detainees during a search operation in the UN-controlled protectorate of Kosovo last April. Malik Karamian with the Kosovo Radio Collective reports from Pristina.
All six soldiers were given non-judicial punishments for the heavy-handed abuse of ethnic Albanians in the eastern village of Robovac. The charges ranged from maltreatment of detainees to obstruction of justice. The search operation in question occurred after NATO forces conducted house-to-house raids, presumably to locate potential organizers of the March riots that claimed 19 lives and left more than 4,000 non-Albanians homeless. One U.S. Army spokesperson, Michael Tolsman, said that the two victims were flex-cuffed, blindfolded, and taken to separate locations to be questioned. Human Rights Watch joined local critics in condemning the NATO-led forces, known as KFOR, for their inability to stop the widespread March riots and for their blunt tactics in dealing with the riots' aftermath. According to a U.S. Army statement, all six soldiers have since been redeployed to the United States. The most severe punishment was a financial penalty of some $4,000. All appeals were denied. This was the Kosovo Radio Collective reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Pristina, Kosovo.
The Food and Drug Administration has approved use of a radio frequency microchip that, once implanted in a person's arm, can provide access to the person's medical records. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
The VeriChip, made by Applied Digital Solutions, is smaller than a grain of rice and would be implanted via syringe. The chip would carry a unique 16-digit patient identification number. When scanned by a handheld reader device, the chip would release the number that would then be used to unlock patient-specific information from an electronic database. Applied Digital Solutions hopes that patients with Alzheimer's or diabetes will use the implant. Yesterday, the Department of Health and Human Services announced the availability of $139 million in grants for that goal. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
New federal statistics released today show that whistleblower complaints of waste, fraud, and abuse in the government have significantly increased in the last 3 years. But as Mitch Jeserich reports, fewer and fewer of them are being investigated.
According to new data released by the Office of Special Counsel, there is about a 70% rise in federal employee complaints since year 2001 over alleged government corruption and waste. In 2001, the Office of Special Counsel, also known as OSC, received 380 complaints, but in 2002, there were 555 new cases and another 535 last year. While complaints of government corruption are on the rise, the number of cases actually investigated has declined. Under 2% of all complaints were probed.
Blowing the whistle to the Office of Special Counsel, where you're supposed to go, is analogous to calling 911 and being put on hold.
Jeff Ruck is the executive director of the federal employees advocacy group, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. He says the rise in complaints is due to an increase of cases being brought by high-ranking government officials.
Under the Clinton administration, peers' typical intake was a park biologist. Now our typical intake is a park superintendent. We're seeing a lot of mid or late career people seeing 25 years of their work being undone in the last 25 months. And the level of unease inside these agencies, particularly the environmental agencies, is reaching a level of high anxiety.
At the beginning of 2004, the Office of Special Counsel had a backlog of over 690 whistleblower reports that have not been looked at. And of the 535 complaints reviewed last year, it initiated just 11 investigations. The OSC would not comment for radio, but in a written statement, the head of the office, Scott Block, said that he was astonished by the number of whistleblower disclosures that haven't been looked at, but he was also optimistic that it would be cleared up by the end of the year. The OSC was, in part, created to provide civil servants an avenue to confidentially report government misdoings. It's also supposed to protect whistleblowers from retaliation by their employers. But that's not happening, according to Jeff Ruck.
Of the hundreds of cases of people that are reporting that they've been retaliated against, not just blowing the whistle, but they've been punished because they did blow the whistle, in not a single case has the Office of Special Counsel represented a whistleblower. So in terms of providing protection for those that blow the whistle, that's an even more serious problem, and one that you're going to be hearing about in coming weeks.
Such whistleblowers who have been retaliated against include former FBI translator Sybil Edmonds, who was fired and then silenced by the Justice Department over her disclosure of inadequacies within the FBI. Park Chief Teresa Chambers was also fired for telling Congress that National Park Police programs were underfunded. And former Medicare actuary Richard Foster was threatened to keep him from telling Congress that the Medicare bill would cost several hundred million dollars more than what the Bush administration touted. Former FAA security expert Bogan Jakovich was ignored by the government when he blew the whistle on the FAA of covering up pre-9/11 security failures at airports. Bogdan Jakovich.
I became so frustrated in the whole process. You walk into a congressman's office without a briefcase full of money and actually expect them to do something, you might as well forget it.
A bill, the Whistleblower Protection Act, that would increase protections for civil servants who report corruption and abuse by the government, will likely die with the end of the 108th Congress. But Tom Devine, with the Government Accountability Project, says such an initiative would do as much as any other legislative effort to secure the homeland.
Exercising free speech is the freedom to warn, like modern Paul Revere's, for years. The terrorists are coming, we're not ready, we're sitting ducks, and this can do a lot more to make our country safe than canceling the Constitution or funding a new multi-billion dollar terrorism industrial complex.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Last night, during the final presidential debate, both John Kerry and George W. Bush were asked whether they see a need for affirmative action. We go to the clip of their response.
During the Clinton years, as you may recall, there was a fight over affirmative action. And there were many people, like myself, who opposed quotas, who felt there were places where it was overreaching. So we had a policy called mend it, don't end it. We fixed it. And we fixed it for a reason, because there are too many people still in this country who feel the stark resistance of racism. And so we have a distance to travel. As president, I will make certain we travel it. Now, let me just share something. This president is the first president ever, I think, not to meet with NAACP. This is a president who hasn't met with the Black Congressional Caucus. This is a president who has not met with the civil rights leadership of our country. If a president doesn't reach out and bring people in and be inclusive, then how are we going to get over those barriers? I see that as part of my job as president, and I'll make my best effort to do it.
Mr. President.
Well, first of all, it is just not true that I haven't met with the Black Congressional Caucus. I met with the Black Congressional Caucus at the White House. And secondly, like my opponent, I don't agree. Well, I have quotas. I agree. We shouldn't have quotas.
That was Senator John Kerry and President George Bush at last night's debate. We're joined now by Maya Rocky Moore, who is the Vice President of Research and Programs at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation and author of the book, The Political Action Handbook, A How-To Guide for the Hip-Hop Generation. Maya, thanks for joining us. I wonder, first of all, if you could just start by, there was some contention there whether Bush had actually engaged in real dialogue with black leaders in the country. One, is that true? And two, how better has Kerry been in reaching out to black communities?
It's absolutely true that there's been major concern about the lack of outreach from the Bush administration, particularly to the Congressional Black Caucus and to the NAACP. The president indicated that he'd met with the CBC. He has indeed met with the CBC twice. However, the second time, the CBC actually had to demand an audience. They literally walked into the White House and demanded to see the president because he refused to meet with them for over 2 years. Now, Kerry, there have been rumblings about Kerry being insensitive to the African-American community. With the election now only several weeks away, we have seen a thawing in terms of his response and his outreach to the African-American community. And so I think that many watchers in the African-American community will be looking towards what else Kerry will be doing, especially in terms of policy, to customize an outreach strategy for this community.
Why do you think it's been so difficult for the candidates to engage in a political dialogue about the issues that are important to black communities?
I think that many candidates are now trying to cater to the center. And African Americans are traditionally seen as more progressive, as being more liberal or left of center. And so there's been a political strategy, both on the Democratic side and, of course, the conservative side, that does not necessarily cater to mainstream African Americans. But on the liberal side or on the Democratic side, there has been a strategy to, when you cater to undecideds and liberal conservatives, then you have to turn more resources away from the base, particularly the African American community. And this has been a bone of contention and an issue of concern for many black leaders.
So then let me ask you just finally, in your opinion, have there been any candidates, even from the third parties, who've done a good job of addressing issues that affect black people and other people of color communities?
Well, I am not trying to undermine the strength of the Kerry Edwards platform, because when you speak about expanding health care opportunities, expanding Medicaid eligibility to poor parents, you're talking about issues that are important to African Americans. When you're talking about stimulating the economy to create more jobs and expanding it so that more people can be included in the access a living wage, like the Kerry Edwards campaign talks about, then you're talking about issues that are important to African Americans. But there are so many more issues that African Americans are concerned about. I think it was really telling when Vice President Cheney was asked in his debate whether or not he knew about the devastation of HIV/AIDS among African Americans, particularly African American women, and he indicated that he had no knowledge of it. So we have work to do in terms of raising the issues that are important to our community and making sure candidates of all stripes pay attention to these issues.
Willie Ratcliffe, publisher for the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, says that for African Americans, Kerry may be a better choice because under a Kerry administration, there'd be more chance of effecting change in public policy.
But when it comes down to it, where the rubber hit the road, the Democrats or the Republicans have been totally against affirmative action. And it has really sent our people to prison because they didn't have jobs. And it just seemed to be a legal slavery going on. And we're backing up instead of making African-Americans and other people of color part of our mainstream system here in this country.
Ratcliffe adds that while the Democrats may be better, the debate last night proves how little African-Americans have figured into this campaign.
This is the third debate, and they waited till the last 15 minutes to even mention anything that African-Americans or people of color, anything that they would be interested in was even mentioned. And so they've been out to lunch, really. The Democrats have been out to lunch, and of course the Republicans stay out to lunch.
Willie Ratcliffe, publisher for the San Francisco Bayview newspaper.
Voting for Empire.
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from his cell on death row.
For millions of people, there exists in their minds, in their hearts, a hunger for change. That hunger is becoming a driving force in the upcoming elections and is being expressed in a way that can best be summed up anybody but Bush. President Bush's cowboy-style diplomacy and the slick way he promised to govern one way, only to actually govern another, has grated on people until many just want to see him quietly pass into retirement. Moreover, the nature of the U.S. economy, with its growing outsourcing and capital flight abroad, also plays into this growing trend. I find it utterly understandable and even quite a good thing, but it has its problems. What this means in summer of 2004 is an embrace of Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, the Democratic nominee for U.S. President. But Kerry, no matter his positive features or his faults, isn't the real reason why Democrats gathered in rapture in Boston recently. They applauded him because they hunger for the political demise of George W. Bush. One of Kerry's selling points is his plan to appeal to Europe to give a hand to the American colonial project in Iraq, instead of the cold shoulder which the Bush regime has received since the invasion and occupation of Iraq. But plans are one thing, obstacles another. Nations don't deal with other nations because they like or dislike a nation's leader. They deal with others based on the guiding light of self-interest. As the British Viscount Palmerston, H.G. Temple, once intoned in the British House of Commons in 1848, quote, "We have no eternal allies, and we have no perpetual enemies. Our interests are eternal and perpetual. And these interests, it is our duty to follow," he said. When or if a President Kerry speaks softly, and perhaps in French, to Europeans, seeking an infusion of European troops into the roiling ruins of a burning Iraq, he will hear a polite yet firm response. "Pardon, Monsieur Kerry, mais non. Sorry, Mr. Kerry, but no." That's because few European leaders can withstand the floods of popular discontent that will accompany the use of their nation's troops in America's imperial exercise in Iraq. They see it as America's problem, not theirs, and they will be hard-pressed to make it theirs. Ultimately, what does it matter if Americans change the face of international policies when it's the same basic policy? While both France and Germany will no doubt lust for entree into the Iraqi oil fields, they cannot ignore the lessons of Spain or Britain. Tony Blair's Labour Party is riding low these days, and Brits are not keen to continue sending their fathers and sons to Iraq. It's clear that Blair can't buy a new term. What the nation needs is not a new face, but a new policy, an anti-imperialist policy. It does not have that option before it in any of the two corporate parties. If that deep, unsatisfied yearning continues to grow, it can only feed even more alienation from the established political system and perhaps to the growing process itself. Or else Kerry will be but another politician promising peace, yet delivering the horrors and loss of war. For Free Speech Radio News, from Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Almost 5 million Americans will not be able to vote in this year's election because they are currently, or have in the past, been incarcerated on a felony conviction. That includes 13% of African American men in the country. While the trend is to ease voting restrictions on this population, progress is slow and uneven. As we continue our month-long countdown coverage to the presidential election, Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut, on the current state of felon disenfranchisement and its historical roots.
Kalila Brown Dean, a professor of African American Studies at Yale University, says there's historical precedent for the disproportionate number of African American males caught in the criminal justice system.
There have been disenfranchisement laws on the books since the founding of the country, but in the post-Reconstruction era, most states tailored their laws to increase their effect on blacks. So as the Constitution gave blacks increased voting rights, these states created these criminal disenfranchisement policies to keep blacks out of the voting booth.
Brown Dean wrote her dissertation on this topic.
So I did a lot of archival research where I was able to find speeches from constitutional conventions where it says rather explicitly, this is our intent, this is our discrimination. You certainly can't find that same language in contemporary discourse, but in that historical period, it was seen as a justifiable legislative act.
Today, African American men are disenfranchised at a rate 7 times the national average. 3/5 of the states deny voting rights to people in prison, on parole, or probation, while 7 states impose a no-exception lifetime ban on voting, and 2 states, Maine and Vermont, allow prisoners to vote. Of the millions of Americans of both genders and all races who have been deprived of the vote, more than 1/3 have completed their sentences.
In most states, the process by which people are removed from the voting rolls or restored to the voting rolls is pretty much a mess. There are very few places where this is done systematically in a way that respects people's rights and respects what the law should look like.
Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project. He says there are 2 problems. Databases of the correctional system often don't jibe with those of the electoral system. And on top of that, up to 1/3 of election officials surveyed this year didn't understand the law as it applied in their state. In 2001, Connecticut passed a law making ex-felons on probation eligible to vote, thereby adding potentially 36,000 people to the voter pool. No one keeps records on this group's voter registration rate, but anecdotal evidence shows that only a fraction of those eligible have registered. They are overwhelmingly poor and black or Latino, and members of these communities are vastly underrepresented on the voting rolls, even if they've never committed a crime. The Connecticut law requires the Department of Correction to give those leaving its custody a certificate of discharge, showing that their voting rights have been restored. Correction officials themselves admit this is often not done. In a survey of 12 citizens currently on probation and therefore eligible to vote, only 1 said he received that form as he left prison. Several others said their probation officer informed them of their right to vote. But to still others, like Dana Murphy, it was a revelation.
I didn't know that I could vote. I heard that when you're a felon that you're not able to vote. And I was walking out of the store, and they asked me if I wanted to register to vote, and I told them, you know, no, because I'm a felon. And they said that I was wrong, that the law changed, and I was able to register, which was really good.
Earlier this week, the voter registration office in New Haven was buzzing with activity. Registrar Sharon Ferrucci.
What isn't happening with the judicial system as far as wherever they're released from, that they should be fully informed of their voting rights. We're working to do this, but there has to be some cooperation from these certain state departments.
Ferrucci holds up the voter registration cards of 2 ex-offenders.
These people want to desperately register to vote, and it's so easy to become a voter. But they're on hold right now because it's getting to the probation officer or it's getting to the courts to get that simple form letter.
Despite all the obstacles thrown in their path, Ferrucci says 2 or 3 probationers are registering to vote each week. The deadline in Connecticut is next Tuesday. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
The National Association of Broadcasters, or the NAB, is the industry group representing commercial radio and TV stations in the U.S. and is perhaps the most influential lobbying body on Capitol Hill. Last week, the NAB held their annual Radio Roadshow Convention in San Diego. Local organizers with the Independent Media Center held an alternative gathering to assess the impact of increasing media consolidation and to open up a dialogue about the successes and failures of the media democracy movement. FSRN's Vinnie Lombardo reports.
We don't want the NAB!
dubbed Media Emergency, the four-day conference, which featured video screenings, musical performances, and street actions, wrapped up on Saturday with a series of workshops and forums addressing efforts to inject diversity and localism onto our airwaves. In general, conference attendees agreed that media consolidation adversely affects what issues are covered and who we hear from. Sonali Kolhatkar, host of the morning show Uprising on KPFK in Los Angeles, says big media needs to expand the range of voices in their news.
It doesn't occur to the corporate media to talk to African Americans about gender issues, or to talk to women about drug issues, or to talk to children about prison issues. There's a very narrow approach. We've talked to blacks about black issues. We've talked about women about to women about women's issues. Men would never have to reflect on, you know, issues of feminism or sexism.
You know, it's the National Association of Big Business. You know, it's the audience, the creativity, everything is marketed.
Radha Vij, a columnist with PoliticalStorm.com, attended many of the panels at the official NAB conference where she interviewed participants for KRBS, a low-power radio station in Oroville, California. Vij says inclusion means defining the terms for what context you're in.
What is representation obviously varies. If I'm at NAB, at the National Association of Broadcasters meeting, and I'm talking about representation, I'm talking about marketing, I'm talking about PR, I'm talking about big business. If I'm at indie media talking about representation, I'm talking about people in the community, activists, creativity, art, craft.
Vij says independent media provides better context to current world events, yet worries that tokenism has crept into much of the reporting.
I think I have a tendency, and people in independent media have a tendency, to be just as swayed by agendas as people in the corporate media, but these agendas are often overlooked within the independent media scene because they're seen as the agenda for the side of good.
Again, Sonali Kolhatkar.
You know, we're a progressive movement, and first and foremost, progressive values are what we look for. But when all those progressive values are espoused in our movements by only white folks, then we have a real problem, because the problem isn't that there aren't progressive brown folks, it's just that we're not talking to one another.
While challenging at times, these issues are vital to discuss, and this weekend's conference in San Diego was a small step forward, yet much dialogue still needs to occur. Jacob Blumenfeld, a DJ on the San Diego web station Radioactive Radio, would like to see the local media democracy movement grow to include groups not directly involved in journalism, and he hopes they begin to speak in their own voices.
We want groups that are not involved in media directly also to be part of the media movement. People that are concerned with gender, with border rights, with globalization, to use the independent media for their outlets. If you base all your protests on the mainstream media, you're going to have two problems. You're going to be angry when they don't cover you because you're not covered. You're going to be angry when they do cover you because they distort you. You can't rely on that anymore. You need to build your own channels.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Vinny Lombardo.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Mylan, and Eric Klein. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. For more information, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.